From time to time, I say what I'm about to say right now, so forgive me for doing it once again. But I have sat here this morning thinking that I have to be the luckiest minister, not only in the city, maybe anywhere. I have had a very happy life, but I have never been happier than I am to be in this church with the warm, witty, talented people who make it up. Some of you can be a part of it too, if you like, because on December the 18th, we will be bringing in a superb group of new members. We have one more inquirers class that will meet on this Wednesday night. If you're interested in this church and you'd like to know more about it, please come. You make no commitment by coming, but if I can let any of my enthusiasm rub off on you, I will gladly do it. We have many visitors. I mention especially Mike and Susan Bloodhart, who are visiting us again from Denver. And we share the happiness of those two people who are so important to the life of this church, Clint and Mary Hufford, who are being visited by their son David. To all of you who have come, the warmest possible welcome. It seems wonderfully appropriate to me that in a church where women provided leadership long before they did in most others, it was a woman who wrote one of our favorite congregational hymns. Her name was Mary Lathbury, a New York City artist who got tired one summer of confinement in her studio and decided to visit the Chautauqua Lectures, where 50,000 people were meeting on the lakeshore every summer to listen to speeches and sermons and take part in small study groups. As Mary's talents became known, she was asked to write a special hymn for the members to sing when they met in their study sessions. She went off to a hillside overlooking the lake, thought about the crowds behind her, and about the story of Christ feeding the multitude at the Lake of Galilee, and wrote the hymn that begins, "Break Thou the Bread of Life." It only has two short verses, and because it speaks of breaking bread, it is often used as a communion hymn, but that wasn't what she intended. "Break Thou the Bread of Life, dear Lord, to me, as thou didst break the loaves beside the sea." It was her way of saying, "Feed us with truth as you once fed the multitude with loaves of bread." And then it expresses one of our most deeply held convictions. "Beyond the sacred page, I seek thee, Lord," which means that while we honor Scripture as a witness to the life and teaching of Jesus, the inspiration that gave birth to those books did not stop with the final verse of Revelation. In a formal sense, the canon of Scripture is closed, and it won't be reopened. But Scripture, in the truest sense of the word, goes on being written. Read very carefully the ancient letter of Jude, for example, and then read very carefully Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail, and tell me there isn't far more challenge for a modern Christian in King's thoughtful plea than there is in Jude's 25 verses. What can it mean in practical terms to find God beyond the sacred page? Well, if we are perfectly honest, wouldn't most of us admit that at times we have found far more inspiration in some recent poem or play or short story than in some of those dreary quarrels about circumcision or eating meat sacrificed to idols that Paul had to write about because the church was bothered by those things? I can only witness for myself, but I have certainly heard the voice of God more clearly at times in a religious poem by Matthew Arnold or T.S. Eliot than in that scripture, for example, where a man asks his servant to kill him quickly because a woman has dropped a millstone on his head and he simply cannot bear the thought of dying at the hands of a woman. He asks his servant to dispatch him quickly and spare him from shame. I get far more inspiration from watching a well-acted version of A Man for All Seasons than I get from reading the book of Hebrews. And I do not honor the Bible if I pretend hypocritically that it is otherwise. But you must remember also that if it had not been for the scriptures, there would not have been those poems by Arnold or that play about Sir Thomas More. If the New Testament represents our roots, never to be forgotten or forsaken, then letters like King's and like Bonhoeffer's from his Nazi prison represent the latest fruit on that tree. In the same way that Peter and James and John did, they interpret the Christian faith and illuminate it by writing in the Spirit of Christ about problems we face right now, some of which the apostles never heard of. The Apostle Paul said some things which my mind accepts without reservation, but there are times when I must part company with Paul or give up both honesty and reason. He was wrong about the nearness of the second coming. He echoed the male chauvinism of his college days, and some of his insults directed at his enemies are as bitter as any unregenerate heart could devise. I use of his life and faith what I can, but as Jesus himself advised me to do, I believe in what I judge to be truth. If I did otherwise and pretended to believe what deep in my heart I do not really believe, my faith would have no authority. It is an interesting fact that the Greek word for authority is exousia, which translates something like this: out of that which is one's own. If your faith is borrowed, handed down, not worked through on your own with honesty, then it has no authority. And you should not be surprised if it makes no difference in how you make decisions or how you treat people. I like the way this idea was expressed 500 years before Christ by a man who came to be called the Buddha, a word that means to become enlightened, to be wise. In a series of epigrams, which I think we interpret properly if we add the word just, he talks about the authority of faith. Here are some of them. Believe nothing just because a so-called wise man said it. Believe nothing just because a belief is generally held. Believe nothing just because it is written down in ancient books. Believe nothing because it is said to be of divine origin. Believe nothing just because someone else believes it. Believe only what you yourself judge to be true. Does that sound too dangerous? Too much responsibility on the individual and not enough on a priest or a guru or a preacher or a book? Well, listen to a question Christ himself asked some people who were asking him questions. And why, he said to them, why can you not judge for yourself what is right? In other words, listen, read, think, experiment, and decide what you really are able to accept as the truth. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free. To which one of his famous students much later, Soren Kierkegaard, responds, I do not know the truth except when it becomes part of me. I keep trying to make that point. You do not know the truth until it becomes part of you. And Christ's point, you must judge for yourself what is right. And the Buddha's point, you must believe only what you yourself judge to be true. I know how dangerous that advice can be for thoughtless, lazy people. But we were not meant to be thoughtless. We were meant to test every truth on the pulse beat of our own heart and to be honest always about whether or not it passed the test. Most of us did not get our religious education in language like this. Truth was packaged, delivered to us under the labels of whatever denomination we grew up in, and we were expected to receive it whether it made full sense to us or not. And absolutism was more often than not the word stamped on that package. As I grew up, I heard Protestants chide their Catholic neighbors for accepting an infallible pope who could not make a mistake when he spoke on matters of faith. But those same Protestants, I lived to discover, only substituted an infallible book from which they drew a variety of equally infallible interpretations. I don't see much difference between the two. The fact is that the truth may often be tentative and qualified. Its terminology may have to be perhaps or maybe. Instead of positively, my child, this is it, and it cannot be understood any other way. No matter how much we yearn for absolutes, sometimes the truth means having to say, I can't be sure. And that truth can make you free. Although no dogmatist will ever believe it. Free to make sense of things. Free to believe what can be authenticated in experience. Free to make up your own mind and be true to it. I like the way an English theologian says it. I am not prepared to hand over to any other person, though wise and learned, or to any institution, however ancient and sure of its position, my right to search for ever-growing and ever-expanding truth. I believe it is far more important for a soul in evolution to believe a few things because it has struggled, thought, and suffered to discover and possess them than it is for it to have a comfortable and orderly faith which it has adopted from any source outside itself. But even as I read such things, I know there will always be a majority too lazy or too frightened to do that. They will find it easier to believe something simply because their parents, their minister, or their church has said it over and over. But if they do, they never know the thrill of personal discovery when something inside them leaps out to embrace an idea and says, other things may or may not be so. This I feel to be true. The kind of excitement, it seems to me, in which the Christian faith began. Christ never said to friends walking in his company, you must believe this list of things. Never. Instead, he was there, and what he said was there, and they could consider and judge. If Peter looks at him one day and says in wonder, you are the Son of God. It was not because someone had told him to say it. He was not reciting a creed formulated by others. He was making his own creed out of experience. And if my religion is to have any validity, I have to do the same thing. I am profoundly glad that this free church is not committed to a creed. We can move tomorrow wherever our recognition of truth takes us. We can believe, as I hope many of us do, in an ongoing revelation of God's will and nature, and why not? Why should there have been inspiration once and no inspiration now? Is it really sensible to think God once spoke through men and women who meditated deeply upon his will and purpose, but has not spoken again since the last word was put on paper 20 centuries ago? And if we think that, let's be honest about what we think. Honesty is the bedrock of any useful faith. It may be a sacrifice to be honest. It may get us into trouble with somebody, but it is always the first thing, because from honesty, God can lead us. He can lead us nowhere when we lie or pretend to believe what we really do not believe. If you're not sure what is your very own in religion, may I suggest an experiment? Try writing out your personal creed. Don't say what you've been told to say or think you ought to say. Don't profess allegiance to things that deep down seem absurd to you. Just write down the convictions you actually hold and by which in your best hours you try to live. You may be surprised by two things: how hard it is to do that and how little there is of it. But a smidgen that belongs to you is worth a mountain of secondhand stuff. I believe in Emerson's great question. You'll need to listen to it carefully. Why should not we have a poetry and philosophy of insight and not of tradition? And a religion by revelation to us and not just the history of theirs. The sun shines today also. By that, and life becomes an adventure. You find in the sunlight new truth, and you rediscover old truth that once meant nothing, and the combination is now yours, sweet and clear like the waters of a spring, and nothing at all like that stale stuff dipped up out of cisterns and handed to you in a cup marked safe. We are not called to safety, but to the danger of growth, to the high risk of traveling a road that has something new beyond each turning of it, and where a voice is forever saying, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall make you free." Then shall all bondage cease, according to Mary's hymn. All fetters fall. Free to believe what we can honestly believe, we find the gift everybody wants. Peace. It is one of the most beautiful of all congregational ideas. It drew me irresistibly when I came to know this faith. The choir has agreed to sing those two lines for you.